Welcome to Season 15 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go! Welcome back. I'm excited you're here. Season 15 moving right along. This week's conversation is one of a kind. Whitney Johnson joins us for our featured conversation. If you're not familiar with Whitney, she was named one of the world's 50 most influential management thinkers by Thinkers 50 in 2017. She has over 1 million followers on LinkedIn. She's the author of 2 best-selling books, Disrupt Yourself, which came out in 2015, and Build an A-Team, which just came out and we cover during the show. But she's just one of these women that will really have you thinking deeper about your career and certainly deeper about your life. And that's exactly what we touch on in the show. I mean, we get going in this one. We get deep, and I love that. She said some things that really jumped out at me. She said, companies don't disrupt, people do. She says, if you change yourself, you can change your organization, and it will make you happier. Every single person on your team is on a learning curve, and you have to optimize everyone's curve. Bored people don't innovate. They get disrupted. I mean, I love that. So we really go deep on a lot of topics and this idea of an S-curve or a learning curve, which we get on. So as you listen to this show, whether you're in the car, you're working out, you're at home, I want you to take your notebook out. I want you to get Evernote out. I mean, I took 3 pages worth of notes, and I want you to beat me, okay? This has got powerful, life-changing stuff in it, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So without further ado, here is one of my favorite conversations with Whitney Johnson. Just a quick word from our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft.com. You're probably thinking, John, isn't that the company you're the CEO of? It is. But without the support of our team, this podcast does not happen. Want to learn more about your company culture? Want to improve your employee engagement? Run our elite culture survey across your organization. We focus on measuring optimistic belief, deep purpose, competitive compensation, army of ambassadors, and effective leadership. So you know exactly where to focus to improve the culture in your company. Find out more at learnloft.com/welderculture. Now on to the show. Well, Whitney, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, early in my career, I really only thought of business being about John and making as much money as I could. And I picked up a book called How Will You Measure Your Life by Clayton Christensen. And it pretty much changed my perspective. And I know you've worked a lot with this man.
Yeah.
What's one lesson you've learned from him? And then maybe give a little perspective about who Clayton is for our audience that is unfamiliar.
Yeah. So such a great question. And that's so wonderful to hear that that book really influenced you. I think I'll give you a background, then I'll talk to you a little bit about that book and the genesis of that, because I think that's interesting as well. So Clayton Christensen is, he wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma about 20 years ago now. And it was his doctoral thesis turned into a book. And he outlined this theory of disruptive innovation, which at its most simple is this idea that a silly little thing can take over the world, whether it's a telephone taking over the telegraph, Toyota disrupting General Motors, or now more recently Tesla, Netflix upending Blockbuster. And so he is the person, when you hear the term disruptive innovation, he coined that. And so he really transformed thinking in the business world over the last 20 years. I had the privilege of being able to work with him for the better part of a decade. First of all, I was working, our family had just moved up to Boston, and interestingly enough, I had reached out to him and sent to him this research report I had written on America Mobile when I was still working on Wall Street. And so I'd read his book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and I think as sometimes happens with people that you admire, you kind of reach out and you're like, oh, I wonder if there's an opportunity to connect, but you don't know what it will look like. And I had sent him that research report. But then a couple of years later, I had the opportunity to work with him on a number of volunteer projects for our church in the greater Boston an area of doing public affairs and trying to build relationships in that community. And so as a consequence of that work that I had done with him, when he decided, okay, you know what, this theory of disruption that we've got, it's really working. And in fact, he was investing some of his personal money of doing things like going long Netflix short Blockbuster. It was working. People had said, you should start a fund. He had never invested. His son was just coming out of business school. And so he knew of my background on Wall Street. And so we started and launched that fund together. So and I did that with him for about 5-6 years before I sold my stake. So for the better part of a decade, whether it was on volunteer work or working in investing with him, I got to work with him very, very closely and see him up close. And a couple, I guess, observations I would make about him and then talk about this book, How Will You Measure Your Life, is he's a really good man. He's not a perfect man, but he's a really good man, and he's a really smart man, and he really, truly, deep down at his core, wants to be good and do good in the world. And that's the one major thing I would say about him. And I think it's so interesting, when he first gave that lecture, I remember I was sitting in one of his classes. It was the very end of the semester, and I want to say it was probably, when I heard him give that lecture, probably 2007. So it was before he had written the book, and just, it was so powerful. I mean, there were people, this is a business school class at Harvard Business School, and people were crying. I was crying. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just so, so powerful. And so I think that, it's just really, and you can talk about, maybe I think your listeners will be really interested to hear how it influenced you, but that gives you at least a quick, some quick summary thoughts of what I've learned from him.
There was one particular story that I just thought was so interesting, when they would have these class reunions and all these Harvard people would come back, and the state of their life as the years went by, you know, the divorces, the failed relationships, the suicide at times, you know, the way their kind of life deteriorated when they were focused on the wrong things. And that really always stood out to me as a, you know, at the time I'm 28 years old, 25 years old. And I was thinking now 10 years later, or just about, and I'm like, Can I be more proactive in thinking the life that I want to have? And I think the impact that I want to make. And I think to hear some of the smartest people in the world and their life breaking apart, it just made such a big impact.
It's really powerful, isn't it? And you really, and the thing that's so interesting, and I think the way he's talked about it, and I think this is a little bit more etched in your brain than mine even, but this notion of, we don't mean to be a bad parent, but we make these decisions like in the moment. And it's really kind of the innovator's dilemma playing out every single day of our life, is, do I spend time with my child, or do I spend another hour on my work? It's hard. It's hard because all of these people at the Harvard Business School, and probably most of the people listening to your podcast, we're incredibly driven people, right? Mm-hmm. We want to accomplish things. So that moment of, do I spend another half an hour getting something done on something that will make me feel good right now because I got something done, versus going and sitting and talking to one of my children for a half an hour about what happened at school today, it's hard to do. But I think he's really making that point of, you know, what are those micro actions that you take on a minute, hourly basis that will add up over time, so that you have a life like a Clayton Christensen versus a life of many of his classmates who realize that, you know, one decision at a time, their life has become not what they had hoped or even had wanted, or at least thought that they wanted.
Well, you bring up an interesting point there about 30 minutes with your kids. So I'm going to ask you a tough question here, Whitney. There's just some scary statistics about new births in America, the amount of them. And with so many people trying to get ahead in their career, you know, they're putting off having children, raising a family, getting married for that matter. Is there an advantage in business to be married with kids, or the opposite?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say I think it depends. And I think it partly depends on your gender. I think for men, 100% it does. I think because it grounds you, it gives you a sense of purpose, like you're working for a reason. I think it also, from an employer standpoint, or if you're an entrepreneur, someone who's funding you, this standpoint of you've got some grounding. And it's interesting. I was actually, and this is somewhat dated, but it's still fascinating to me. I was recently reading, oh my goodness, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Mm-hmm. He did this research, researched 100 of the most successful people in the country. And he found that every single one of those people, and at the time it was all men, they all had a woman who loved them and supported them. Like support structure, right? Every single one to a one. And that to me was really fascinating. So I would say for a man, absolutely. For a woman, I think it's mixed. What I would say is that in my own experience, and I think most women would tell you, when the burden of parenting still tends to fall on women, although that's been slightly different in my case, but I'm going to speak in general terms, that tends to fall to women. There's this juggling that has to take place, or tends to take place, that makes it potentially less attractive to an employer and makes it a little bit difficult for women to focus, certainly in the short term. That being said, what I would posit, and I believe this to the core of my soul, if you can be a parent, if you can take care of your parents, you have had a masterclass, a crash course in soft skills. So to the extent that you've done the work of getting the domain expertise that you need to do any given job, that ability to parent makes you potentially a secret weapon. I remember Tom Peters, probably 20 years ago now, said, and I'm going to get this quote wrong, but he just said, the one thing or sort of secret power, secret weapon that we all have at our disposal in our organizations, if we will let it be, are the women. And so anyway, that wasn't an exact answer because it's very, very nuanced, but those are some initial thoughts on the topic of that very difficult question that you just asked.
I know, it's a hard one. But I've been thinking about it a lot, and I've never heard the perspective of it being different for men and women. I was sitting at an event two nights ago, and a pretty high up executive at a major bank, she's having her first kid, she's, nearing 40, and a man on her team is out on paternity leave. And it was interesting, this woman's about to have her first child, and you could sense some judgment about that man being out on paternity leave, even at a big bank. And it was like one of those moments that I'll remember for some time, knowing that she's about to have this major event, and you don't know what it's going to do to her career, whether it's going to be good, bad, indifferent. But it's just, I think about it as an entrepreneur a lot, meaning I have to be home by a certain time, Whitney. I have responsibilities that a 25 or a 30-year-old or a 35-year-old doesn't have that isn't married with children, and just the amount of time they could spend on it. And that's, but I do get very deep purpose, I mean, I love it. It's the best.
Yeah. So John, I would say this goes back to the question that you posed at the very beginning of our conversation, or the book title of How Will You Measure Your Life? The reality is that if all you care about is building a business, then probably having a spouse or a child, at some level, it's going to distract. If all you care is about rearing children, and doing that, then having work is going to distract. I believe, and this is based on my in-depth study of Jungian psychology, is that in order for every man and every woman to truly grow up, we have to develop both of our masculine and our feminine characteristics. And so you as a man have masculine, feminine. I as a woman have masculine, feminine. And the masculine is the ability to wield power, control situations. And the feminine is to be able to love, our capacity for relatedness. And in order to grow up, we have to develop both of those. And so being a parent, being in the home allows you to develop that capacity for relatedness. Finding ways to serve in the community allows you to develop that. And work, by and large, gives you an opportunity to develop the masculine. And so then the question I think for all of us becomes is, how do we figure out how to be both a ship, develop the masculine, and be a harbor, develop the feminine, if our goal is in fact to truly grow up and to do both? What that means though is you might do it at different times, and it certainly means it's messier. But if our long game is to measure our life as being a fully developed, stable person, then we play that messy game, because that's the game, because we're playing the long game, not the short game.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really insightful stuff, Whitney. You, before we get into your new book, Build an A-Team, you just, in that kind of overarching description, you've kind of hit something on the head here, which is you've kind of danced around this idea of success, or how people define success differently, what you want in your life. How do you define success?
Okay. Well, so because I'm a very, because I'm very complex, as are all human beings, I'm reading a book by an author named Brandon Sanderson, fantastic fantasy author. I'd say he's to our generation, this generation, what Orson Scott Card was to the generation, you know, 25, 30 years ago, who wrote Ender's Game. But he said, hypocrisy is just people in the process of changing. So with that, I will share, you know, I think for me, my fundamental, when I'm at my absolute best, is my definition of success is to, I'll just say it, to be a witness of Jesus Christ at all times and in all things and in all places. So that's my fundamental. If I want to take that out of the religious sphere, I would say it's to be good and do good, regardless of what your religious persuasion is. That being said, I have other, you know, goals that to me make me feel like I'm being successful. And do they derive to this other one? Yes, on my best days they do. But then there are just aspects of me that I just, you know, I care about the brass ring. I'm driven. I want to accomplish things. So for me to say that I don't would be completely and totally disingenuous. So some things that for me look like success are, you know, I just published a book. Am I able to sell lots of books? Am I able to earn money? And part of the reason I think earning money is so important is it's a validation of your ideas. Do people find these ideas valuable? And if I'm able to earn more money, then I'm able to expand my ability to do good beyond my physical presence. And so those are some of the things of, you know, do I sell books? Are the ideas that I have around personal disruption, around the idea that companies don't disrupt, people do, of building great teams, are those being promulgated, and are people adopting them? Because I believe that if you will understand that if you change yourself, you can change your organization, will make people happier and also make businesses, by the way, be able to ship more product. Those are all things that I measure as success as well. So again, it's complicated. I think with anybody you talk to, it's always going to be nuanced, but that gives you some of the different shades of how I think about it.
Yeah, it's the fact that you say it so eloquently, like, you know, every time I ask people that question, you know, particularly people that haven't really thought about it intentionally, they have a hard time even getting out the answer. And the fact that you know where your faith perspective is, you know, then what you're trying to do professionally, and you see a blend of the two, you know, it reminds me a lot of the earlier answer you gave around, you know, the blend of home and work. And so really interesting stuff. Let's get into the book. The new book is called Build an A-Team, Play to Their Strengths and Lead Them Up the Learning Curve. Builds upon your prior work, obviously. Give our listeners just a little bit of a sense for why this book now.
Yeah. So in the work that I did with Clayton, you know, we were applying the S-curve, which was popularized by E.M. Rogers in in 1962. And I was looking at this and I was like, okay, this is interesting. Just like this theory of disruption isn't just about products and services, it's also about people. I think we can take this S curve that we're looking at to try to figure out how quickly an innovation will be adopted to understand the psychology of disruption or the psychology of change. And so as you know, the last 5 years, I've been researching and codifying this framework of personal disruption, which I initially talked about in Disrupt Yourself. Like, how do you know when it's time for you to make a change? And then once you do, how do you do it successfully? And so in our research, we came up with 7 different levers of change that you can pull that can move you along that learning curve more quickly. Well, one of the things that happened after I wrote this book is I would have a lot of people say to me, okay, I got it. I get it. And but I don't necessarily want to change jobs. What does this look like in the workplace? How can I disrupt myself and keep the same job? And so Disrupt Yourself, whereas it was for you, the individual, Build an A Team is building on or answering that question. How do I create an environment where people can disrupt themselves? And more importantly, I would say is this isn't just to be nice to the people who work for you. How do I use this idea of the learning curve and use it to, if I can understand it and get it right, I'm actually going to build a team that is a great team, a team that can innovate and therefore one who can manage through change if I will allow or recognize and acknowledge that every single person on my team is on a learning curve and how do I optimize those curves?
Yeah, and you said in the book, you said you build a great team when you optimize everyone, which I think right. is an interesting perspective. I mean, that you use that word optimize, right? Optimize everyone. How do you get, as a manager of a team, one, how do you ensure that you're optimizing yourself on the learning curve when you probably have a great level of mastery in your particular field? So that's the first question. And the second part is, how do you make sure your people are on that curve?
Okay. All right. So let's back up just a second and then I will answer that question. So you yourself and then your people. Okay. So if you think about this learning curve at the low end, it's in the shape of an S, and at the low end, you're going to be doing a lot and it feels like nothing's happening. And so you're going to be in that area probably for 6 months to a year, and you're going to come home a lot of times and be like, why did I take this job? I don't know what I'm doing. So this is an era of inexperience. Even if you have domain expertise, for example, you can have domain expertise, but now be the CEO and you don't know what you're doing, right? So there are ways for you to still not know what you're doing, or you've got a brand new team configuration, or you've got new clients. There are lots of different ways to be on a learning curve, not necessarily just around domain expertise. So that's the first 6 months to a year. And then you move on to the back of that S after about a year, where you start to really feel like you know what you're doing, and you do a little bit and a lot happens. All your neurons are firing, you know enough, but not too much. So this is the period of actual engagement. Really high engagement. And if you're willing to give your people stretch assignments, it will be even higher engagement. And then after about 3 years, guess what? You're now at the top of that curve, that S. And so it's this mountaintop, and there's this vista for you to see all the good that you've accomplished. But that plateau can become a precipice, because what happens when you get to the top of the curve? You stop learning. You've actually figured out mostly what you're doing. And because you're no longer enjoying the feel-good effects of learning, you can actually get bored. And so the way you optimize as a leader is at any given time, you want to have 15% of your people at the low end, because while they're inexperienced, they also ask questions like, why do we do it like this? And that question opens the door to innovation. You also at any given time want 70% of your people in that sweet spot on that steep part of the curve. And this is the optimization question you asked. And then 15% at the high end who can say, here's how we do it. Here's some things for you to think about, bring people along, but knowing that they're only going to be at the top for 6 months to a year, because again, they're bored and you don't want them to get complacent, and they are willing to help and they are willing to bring people along because they know that there's another curve on its way. So there's the mantra for me is you learn and then you leap and then you repeat. So I'll stop there, see if you have any questions, and then we can circle back to the other question you asked about what this looks like.
Yeah, you you know, I think you even say bored people don't innovate. They get disrupted. And so
Bingo.
You get to the end of that curve in that last 15%. So you have 15 at the bottom left. You have 70% in the middle. You have 15 in the top right. And if bored people don't innovate and they get disrupted, how does then a manager in a role or a leader of a team in that role continue to ensure that they don't get disrupted, or
right.
What new curves do they, do you see what I'm going with there?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Okay. So there's a couple different things. So, there are different, so let's
let me
take
give you a practical example. Actually,
yeah, perfect. Good. Let's workshop it. Let's coach this example. Go
yeah,
for it.
Because I have team members that have absolutely, you know, moved up that curve. And
right.
I can see it happening in technical skills or learning coding or, you know, doing things that really help the business from a technical skill perspective. Then now at 5, 6, 7 years, I can almost feel myself plateauing in some areas because you keep doing the same task as running the business and writing. And, you know, there's always another idea that could get me to a next curve. But how do I continue to ensure that I don't get complacent in the way that I'm leading my team?
Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. Okay. So let's do it for you. Let's just start with you, cause that'll be more fun, cause you're more interesting than anybody else, right? We're all the most interesting person on the face of this earth. Okay. So one initial thought that I have, and I don't think this completely answers the question, but we'll come to it. So one of the people that I profile in Build an A Team is a fellow named Gary Ridge. He's the CEO of WD-40, and he's been the CEO for 20 years. And I think he's probably getting close to the top of the curve, but he's been in the sweet spot for a long time. And I think one of the reasons he's been in that sweet spot for so long is they've expanded into new markets. So for example, when he first came on board, they weren't in China. Now they're in China, and China is a big part of their business. Mm. And so having to figure out how to go into China, that's a big learning curve, right? How to open up a whole new market that you know nothing about. And so you're able to jump, so you can jump to new curves without changing roles. So I think that's one thing for someone like you to be thinking about is, okay, so for example, you've got this podcast. Have you written a book already?
I have. Yeah.
Okay. How many books have you written?
One.
Okay. So you've written one book. You do a podcast. What else does your business consist of?
We have assessments per leaders to understand their strengths and weaknesses.
Yep.
And then we have a culture survey to run across an organization to look at the five building blocks of elite culture and how they measure up against the competition.
Okay. And do you do a lot of speaking?
I do.
Okay. So, all right. So you do kind of all the things that you would need to be doing in your business. So a couple of thoughts that I would have for you is one. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well,
you were going to say something.
It kind of feels like a new season, right? Like we're speaking more and more. So, you know, previous seasons or previous areas of the business, I wasn't speaking as much. And so it feels like 2018, it will be more about speaking and being in, you know, sharing the ideas in a different capacity than the way we're sharing them now. So that could be a new curve.
Totally. Okay. And I would say in one way, because here's the thing, you don't necessarily have to change curves. So people sometimes say to me, well, this person's been in this role for 4 years and they need to jump. And I'm like, well, are they doing a good job? And they're like, yeah. Are they having fun? Yeah. And they're like, well, then they're still in the sweet spot. So it could be that there are lots of things that you're doing that are prolonging it. But for example, so speaking, I think speaking is a great one. If you're really enjoying speaking, then one thing, a new learning curve could be is, okay, how am I going to, if I'm giving 20 speeches a year, do I give 40 speeches this year? Or how do I double? What do I need to do to double what people are paying me to speak? Or I want to speak in these three places. So that's not a jumping to a new curve, but it's certainly giving yourself a stretch assignment so that this curve gets extended. And it's scaring you enough that you're like, I don't quite know how to do this. And so I think for someone like you, and probably a lot of people that are listening to your podcast, where you've got this portfolio of things that you're doing, it might be that you add something else to the portfolio. Although it sounds like you've got kind of the portfolio that you want. What I would suggest you do is really think about this law of friction and go back and read the chapter around people on sweet spots and be like, okay, what friction do I need to give us? Mm. What do I need to say? Okay, our business right now is generating X and we have been planning on going to 1.5X, but you know what? We're going to go to 3X and we're not going to do 3X in 5 years. We're going to do 3X in 2 years. I'm being kind of obnoxious right now, but you get my point,
yeah.
Right? And what do we have to do to make that happen? And so that to me is, it's almost like I would look at it and I'd say, you know what, for your business, it sounds like on the one hand, you're in the sweet spot, but on the other hand, and I'm throwing down the gauntlet here, I would say maybe you're actually at the low end. Mm. And so what do you need to do to like really, really push yourself? And so I think to me, that's where I would, if we were doing a coaching session right now.
Our listeners just got a master class in giving a coaching session about you.
Exactly. If we were doing a real coaching session. Yeah. So that's my quick back of the envelope thought for you and for your listeners who are saying, you know, I actually really do enjoy my work. Like I don't really want to change.
Right.
Well then, okay. Then impose some constraints. And I think that that's so important. And I love, there's this wonderful story and you may have heard of it, but this story about it's by this fellow, he's an educator and religious leader named David Bednar. And he talks about this truck and there's this man who really wants this truck and he goes out and he buys the truck and it's really for emotional reasons. He doesn't need the truck. And so he's like, okay, my investment committee, my wife doesn't like that I bought this truck. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to prove to her why this truck is so valuable. So of course he's going to chop wood. Well, he starts driving up the mountain and it's snowing, even though it's October, it shouldn't be snowing, but it is. And so when he finally lands, starts to, you know, say, I'm going to chop wood, the truck, it just gets completely stuck. And he's like, okay, now I've got a problem because I don't know how I'm going to get home. And by the way, my wife is going to tell me I told you so. So what does he do? He gets out of the truck and he just starts to chop wood and he chops wood and he chops wood and he chops wood and he loads it all on the back of the truck. And because hope springs eternal, it's the end of the day, he's exhausted, he turns the key, and magically the truck gets unstuck and he's able to drive back the mountain, down the mountain. And so it was the load in the truck that gave it traction to go back down the mountain. And I would argue for you and for everybody listening, it is the load, it is the weight, it is the challenges, the friction, the stretch assignments that give you the friction you need to climb your curve. And so if you love the curve that you're on and you're not actually feeling like you need to jump to a new curve, that's fine, but give yourself constraints to make it super exciting again.
Oh, I just love that story. So it's the manager, you mentioned it's the manager's job to manage the individual learning of everyone on your team.
So it's both. It's a both and. It's okay. A both and.
It's a
right?
Both and.
It's a both and. Yeah,
so how absolutely. Do the best... So when how do the best leaders do this? No, meaning, you know, how do you let that learning curve really play out if a team member either doesn't seem to think they need to learn more or conversely, they just don't seem to be growing in their current role?
Okay. So I'd say the first thing is to introduce this framework to them and help them understand it so that they understand, okay, low end in experience, middle sweet spot, high end board, 6 months, a year to 3 years, 1 year. So they have that framework in their head. I think that's a good starting place. And we have on our website, this diagnostic that you can take. If you go to whitneyjohnson.com/diagnostic, you can figure out where you are on the curve. Now, that being said, you said, what if a person actually isn't climbing the curve? You have to, first of all, figure out, okay, are they not climbing the curve because they're not trying? Because that's one thing. But are they potentially not trying because it's not the right curve? If you look at the disruption theory, you know that your odds of success are 6 times higher when you pursue a disruptive course. You play where no one else is playing, take on distinctive strengths, et cetera. But that 6% to 36%, so there's still a 64% chance that it's the wrong curve. And because whenever you and I apply for a job, because we don't value what we do best, We actually talk about on our resume all the things we worked hard to learn how to do. We don't actually talk about what our superpowers are. And so it's quite probable, not probable, but possible that you're going to hire people and they're going to tell you that their superpower is X, when in fact, as you work with them, you realize their superpower is Y. And so if people are kind of stalling at the low end of the curve, sometimes they just need to put in the time, those 6 months, those year, but sometimes it's the wrong curve. And so we need to be willing to kind of suss that out. Are they working just really hard and it's just not working? And so then you say, okay, well, where could they work? Because I know this person wants to do a good job. I know this person is willing to play as a team, play on the team. So let me get them into the place where they're going to be able to, where they're playing to their strengths and therefore be able to contribute in a meaningful way.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I saw that you said nearly every human is on the lookout for growth opportunities. And if a person can't grow with a company, they will grow away from it. So I imagine then that if you can't get someone on the right learning curve as a leader of a team, then in their very nature, they're going to grow away from the team and potentially could hurt culture, hurt morale, whatever it may be.
Right. And I would say, John, that I actually believe this, and I can't prove it, but I really believe this. So maybe I should try to prove it, is that I think sometimes, you know, in the United States anyway, 10 to 15% of the people lose their job or fired or laid off every year. And, you know, I've had people and, you know, I've lost my job and I've had people say, well, you know, it was politics. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Like politics just means that you were like trying to play on this playground and you couldn't play there because there were other people who were bigger than you were. And you can't really walk through sort of doors of opportunity when there's a bouncer standing in the door. So I actually have this hypothesis that when you get fired or laid off, you know, you needed to jump to a new learning curve. Like you knew in deep in your heart and soul, you knew, and you wouldn't go. And so the universe, it helped you out. It gave you that nudge that you needed to go. And so what you do with it then is your choice. Sometimes people stall out because they can't see it for what it is, which is a huge opportunity. But you and I both know people who have said, best thing that ever happened to me when right. I got fired or lost my job, it's because they needed to jump to a new curve and they weren't quite ready to do it.
It's so true. It really is. And I think if we're all being honest with ourselves, no matter what job you've ever done, you probably feel like at some point you didn't jump fast enough now that you've heard this. There's a follow-up question to that though, Whitney, and that is thinking of the size of organizations that people work in. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of battled this, and again, I can't prove this either, but you know, when in smaller organizations or small to medium-sized businesses, the default thinking is, well, there's just not that many places to go in this organization, and that's why this role has high turnover, or that's why we don't keep our best people, because there's just not that many places to go. We don't have that many layers or that many new jobs. And then conversely, on the other side of the coin, in large organizations, you know, someone can just go to another division or another team to get a new curve, or, you know, there's lots of places to go. How do you think about the size of an organization? And then in terms of the opportunity to grow within it?
Yeah. So I would say it's hard in both sizes of organizations, but for different reasons. So I think in a large organization, yeah, there's plenty of different things that you could do, but because things get so structured and ossified that it sometimes is very difficult for people to be able to move around, even though there are plenty of opportunities available to go do something different inside of the organization. And in part, because if you're a high performer, so often you have a boss, like I did when I was at Merrill Lynch, who said, you know, they didn't say this, but they did say this effectively. We like you right where you are. You know, if I let you go, then I'm going to lose because I'm losing this high performer. I've got a fiefdom. I deserve this fiefdom. I can't let you go. So we start hoarding talent. So I actually think in a large organization, or maybe in a small one too, that's actually the bigger problem is it's not that there aren't opportunities, just that the person, the boss, and that's part of the reason why I wrote this book, is not willing to let you jump. I would say in a smaller organization, yeah, you're so So yes, there are fewer opportunities, but at the same time, I think they're with a smaller organization, a couple of options. Number one is if you've got a person who comes to you and says, you know, I really want to be doing X, and you're like, well, you can't do X, but if you can find a problem that our organization needs to solve or could solve and make a case for me about how it needs to be solved and how you can solve it, then we'll create a job for you. I think we don't do that enough of just being like, where do we need to go and how could you do it? And when you're a small organization, you've kind of got it's a little bit easier to do because you don't have so many strictures in place. The other thing I would say is if that doesn't work, you know, why we can let people jump to new curve on our team inside of our company, to a client, to a vendor. Because even if a person leaves, if you make it possible for them to leave, then you have become their agent, and they will become ambassadors for you, for the organization. I mean, think about Coach Calipari at the University of Kentucky, right? 1 year, he says, come do everything you can, and then I'll let you jump to a new curve. Well, guess what? Guess who wants to play for Coach Calipari? A lot of people, because he's become a talent magnet, because they know that he's not going to hold them back. He's going to do what they want to do for a year and then send them on their way. And I think if you can get a reputation for being that kind of person, then you don't have to worry about talent leaving, because there's always going to be more talent that wants to work for you.
Oh, I love the example of Coach Calipari, because he's done – and then did you ever see that they did a 30 for 30 on him, and you saw all his old players come back and what he had meant to them in their journey. It was awesome, and I was just so impressed. He's got a kind of a negative rap, but you see what he's doing for these men, and it's just a perfect example of letting them go, knowing that that's the next step.
Right, of building an A team, and as a consequence, Bill Walsh,
Coach K,
they end up building vast networks of A teams across their career. And this goes back to your question of how will you measure your life. Mm-hmm. I think that someone who knows that at the end of their life there are 10, 20, 100, 300 people that you made a significant difference in their life because you were willing to see them as a real resource, not something to be just discarded. That's huge to me. And if we can play that game, then we will really measure our life and find that we are anything but wanting.
Well, you brought it full circle for us. Thank you. Let's end on two final fun questions. The first is, we talked a little bit about earlier about kids and things of that nature. What's harder, leading at work or leading at home?
Say that again.
What is harder, leading at work or leading at home?
They're both hard for me in different ways. Yeah, it's really, you know, I know that most people probably say leading at home by far, but I find that we have a really happy family life. And I think a lot of that, I have to give credit to my husband and my children. What I would say, the thing that's hard about leading at home, and certainly at least more obviously hard about leading at home, is that because you are more yourself at home than you are anywhere else, you know, the fact that there, any sort of hypocrisy is, you know, writ large, they see it like crazy. So that's hard. And in the terms of, you know, do what I say and not what I do, that's a little bit hard. Like I'll be like, don't eat that much sugar. And then my kids see me making chocolate chip cookies. That's a problem. But at the same time, what I would say is that when it comes home, while there's that, you know, you have children, you have a spouse, hopefully, that no one loves you more than they do. And so when they see your weaknesses, but they're willing to forgive you if you ask for forgiveness. And who better to see your strengths than the people who know you best? And so I think that if we will listen to them, they can give us some really wonderful clues about not only areas that we can improve upon, but really where our true strengths are. And so I would say home is harder, but it also has the bigger upside. And then work kind of nestles into that middle of the pack, but it still has tremendous challenges.
You get to give one bit of advice to our audience from your life or from this book. What would that one bit of advice be?
I'm going to give two pieces of advice because I'm a disruptor. So the first is that let the people around you, whether they're in your family, whether they're in your workplace, to learn and then leap and repeat. Make it possible for them to do that. And then the second piece of advice would be is if you feel scared and if you feel lonely at any given time, then you are a disruptor. So you're on the right path, because that's what you do when you disrupt. You play where no one else is playing. And so in those moments when you do feel scared and lonely, take courage, take heart, because it means you're treading a path. You're doing something new, and that's exactly what you want to be doing.
Well, we can't thank you enough for your time and the wisdom you shared today, the insight. It's you can tell immediately the work that you've put in your career. You very well could be the smartest person we've ever had on the show. So I appreciate you taking the time, sharing the wisdom, being willing to go places that most people aren't, and we'll make sure to link to the right places. Where can people find out more about the book to get it, where they can find out more about you? Send people to the right places.
Yeah. So I think probably the easiest is if you go to my website, whitneyjohnson.com/diagnostic, if you want to take the S-curve locator, or if you do whitneyjohnson.com/A-team, you can download the first chapter of the book. Those are probably the best places to start.
And the book, Build an A-Team, Play to Their Strengths, and Lead Them Up the Learning Curve, in bookstores everywhere and on Amazon. We'll make sure to link to them in all the right places. Whitney Johnson, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on another week of the show. If you like this, do me a favor and share it with a colleague or a friend, or leave a comment, review, and recommendation wherever you listen to podcasts. Anything that would help us spread the message of leadership, it would mean a great deal to me in my heart. Until next time, be a good leader at work and at home.